The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts,
Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. The BioRevolution Podcast, this time Lab in the Loop, AI bridges to the wet lab. We have a fantastic guest today at the table, Easy, but as always, we start with our quotes and then you do the kudos and the introduction of our guest, I guess.
Exactly. Let's do that. We have two quotes today. One is from Viv Regev from Genentech, and she's like a pioneer in the systems biology field. Actually, I was reading her papers when I myself was still in the lab, which is a long time. So there's a long way to bridge to the wet lab. For me, it's like almost 15 years by now. So
I'm 20 years.
Oh, it's a long time. Wow.
I do not miss it that much either. But what she says about the partnership that Genentech struck with NVIDIA some years ago, AI, the lab and the clinic together to uncover otherwise inaccessible patterns in the vast quantities of data to design experiments to test those patterns. So that already gives us a hint of the lab in the loop, how that could work. The other one is from Jeffrey Van Malsen, the flagship general partner and head of Leela Sciences. It's another lab in the loop company. And I'll only read the start of this quote from an Endpoints article because I think it's a very nice metaphor for it. Building a beautiful, super intelligent mind for science requires a new kind of body for science. And that, I think, refers to the lab in the loop approach, which I also very much like. Happy to have you here, Thibault.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, you're a podcaster yourself, so we will learn, I think, some interesting things about the guests that you have on your podcast who are at the intersection of tech and drugs, which is your newsletter and your podcast, which I think is going very successfully. And I think it's very interesting to have a conversation with a fellow scientific communication professional who can give the insights into this super interesting emergent field. So you have been in this area between life sciences, technology and publishing also in the past for over 20 years. You're now with Zülke Group, but you also have this angle of communication with a very active LinkedIn profile with the podcast and with the newsletter. So happy to have you.
Thank you for having me. I think it will be a very interesting conversation today, I hope.
It's not tech and drugs and rock and roll, but it's tech and drugs.
Well, I mean, you know, like when I was designing the logo, when I asked my agent to design the logo, you know, I wanted one of these retro type of things that you have in a, in an American diner. So it's a very rock and roll field. I mean, some people might not see it that way, but I think it's a super exciting field to be in at the moment.
Absolutely. Can you explain why?
Why? Because, you know, I think, okay, so that could be an entire podcast on this topic, but, you know, when people talk about having a mission when you work in something, you know, like I cannot think about other industry where there is a more important mission than in life science in general and in pharmaceutical industry, because in the end, we're developing drugs, you know, we're developing drugs or patient. And I start most of my talk like that. I say, you know, there are something like 24,000 known diseases. 14,000 are rare disease. We have between 3,000 and 4,000, 5,000 drugs on the market, but those drugs are not for 5,000 disease. They are for far less because you have maybe 10 drugs against the same indication. And then from those 4,000 or 5,000, you have maybe 200 to 300 that are actually curing the disease. Every year, there is 50 new drugs that go through regulatory approval. So if we go at this pace, we need another 500 years until we cure all diseases.
Yeah, good statistics. Yeah. I would be, before we dig into the AI field, and we're extremely interested in that, but at the same time, when you mentioned this, and I have to ask this question, we're at the crossroads where healthcare systems are on the edge, where the question, the basic question is, how on earth are we going to pay for this in the future? And at the same time, you have this revolution that is going on with new findings, new drug development, quicker drug developments, probably drug development under €1 billion per drug. But those crossroads exist, and we have to ask ourselves the question, where do we want to be headed with this?
Yeah, I think there are multiple ways of looking at this problem. So I think, first of all, I agree with you. If we just continue to do the things the way we do, it's not going to work. Plus, we are getting a lot of innovative treatment. You know, like yesterday I was listening to the radio, like normal treatment as you are aging, I think there is like 5 years ago, there was one treatment that would cost 80,000 euro a year. And now I think, at least it's in France from the official number, we have something like 40 or 50 or even more. So don't quote me exactly on that, but that really increased a lot. Then if you look at cutting edge treatment like gene therapy, how many treatments exist now that are over $1 million a year? I think the most expensive is like $4 million a year. Yeah. So that's
incredible,
not sustainable.
Numbers.
Not sustainable, but those things are like literally life-saving. I mean, you know, there are things, yeah, you have an injection that cure a disease that will kill someone. So that's a true innovation, the life-saving thing, the thing for which I'm in this industry because I think it's wonderful. However, to your point, we already have huge deficit in all the healthcare system in the world, so we can't continue like that. So I think a couple of things to consider. First, preventive medicine. Most of our systems are designed to treat instead of prevent. So, you know, like you, I'm sure, yes, you're familiar with Neko Health because I think you thought about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So for me, that's the future of medicine, you know, like do something before you get sick.
Yeah.
Here, I mean, in Germany, if you go to your doctor and say, hey, you know, I'd like to do a blood panel like every 6 months with lots of analysis, can we do it? They're like, no, if you want to do it, you have to pay and it's a lot. So I think for me, you know, it's moving to more preventive. But then you mentioned another thing which we'll dig into a lot today. It's if drugs, you know, like the statistics for the drug, it's a typical statistic, is 10 to 12 years of development, 95% failure rate. The number that everyone is using in terms of cost is 2 billion, but actually the most up-to-date number is 6 billion when you look at the top 16 or 17 pharma companies. We need to get this number way smaller. I mean, it needs to cost maybe a couple of hundred millions. It needs to take 3 years and not 12 years. And then eventually it will be something much more sustainable and you will be able to treat way more diseases. For me, that's the two direction where it needs to go.
Super exciting. Let's dive maybe a little bit into the impact that AI has on drug discovery, development, science itself. It's interesting because this is our 51st episode. So like we've been talking about this a lot and we just did a review of all the AI things that we talked about. And it turns out that I think in almost 20 episodes, we had an AI topic. So this is really what's
almost
happening.
Half. Incredible.
Yeah, what's happening in biotech right now. And it's also interesting because we went back and listened to the predictions that we made some like 4 years ago, some of them.
How good were you with your predictions?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that we started before large language models became a thing. So back then it was like, okay, natural language processing doesn't work that well. And then suddenly it worked very well. And then things, I mean, changed drastically because of that. And we did not predict this. But I think many other people didn't either. But would you say, like, I mean, the impact that AI has on drug discovery development on the industry, are we overestimating or underestimating it at the current stage?
That's a great question. And I consider myself as an AI enthusiast, but I also try to be an AI realist. So I think it's such a hard question because you can look at it from so many different angles. So if you really try to be as rational as possible and look at the facts, I think there are a couple of companies that have demonstrated very strong signals showing what is it that AI can do to the discipline of drug discovery and development? I mean, I write very often about in silico medicine because in silico medicine has a really big pipeline and they've been able to demonstrate that you can take the preclinical steps that take normally 5 to 6 years and compress it. I think the best they've done was 8 months, but on average, 18 months. So it's, you know, like less than half of the time to do it. And also in terms of cost, I mean, they reduce the cost dramatically. Now, if you want to be a bit more critical, and if you zoom out, you say, well, how many drugs actually that AI developed drugs, and we'll define what does it mean an AI developed drugs? I think it's very important to define that. But how many AI developed drugs made it to the market? At the moment, almost none. So depending on how you look, so there is this paper from the Boston Consulting Group that was published at the end of 2023.
A couple of times. Yeah,
it's a great paper. And actually, I was mentioning I have another podcast later today where we took this paper and look at what happened 24 months later. So I'm working with a scientist who have a really nice system where you can really do like very interesting search and validation. And the interesting thing is that there is not a lot more that came from, you know, like if you try to extend the list. So, you know, I wrote an article recently, where are the AI developed drugs? So that's one thing. And what I was mentioning from the paper, just to go back a little bit, there's not a lot of drugs that made it to the market. So there was one in the Boston Consulting paper, there was one drug that was marked as marketed, but it was a repurposed drug. Mm. So it was not a drug that was like discovered where the target was discovered. So it was drug repurposing, which is actually a great use case for AI, but it's not like from target discovery all the way to commercial. I think there is another one from Lantern Pharma that made it to the market, but that I will have also to double check. So that's one thing that I will discuss.
But isn't that also due to the fact that AI hasn't been around simply long enough to make it commercial?
One also has to say that certain applications, for example, in medicinal chemistry, use older forms of AI for a while already, right? So it depends really where, as you say, I mean, it's a definition. What is the use of AI?
But AI is not just LLM.
But the generative AI, the deep learning based AI that we're using, I think this hasn't been around for that long. So we would not, I mean, unless suddenly the timelines would be compressed like super significantly, I mean, we would not even expect that many AI discovered drugs to make it to the market, right?
So yes, you definitely have a point. I think, again, if we split things in two, I'm not surprised that, you know, all the embedding of AI tools into drug discovery and development process hasn't made it yet or hasn't had an impact yet on large pharma or on existing, you know, mid-size and large pharma, because there is a lot of inertia. It's complex to change processes. However, why I'm saying I'm surprised is that we still have a lot of tech bios. And I would have expected with all the investment going into TechBio to see more of their pipeline making it to the clinical phase. Maybe again, it's the over-optimistic me who wanted to see more. And I think we should not draw too many conclusions. Now, I think the critical time will be what happens in the next 5 years? Because now it's really moving from experimenting with AI to bringing AI into production also in the large pharma. Like, what will Eli Lilly do in the next 5 years? What will Roche do in the next 5 years? AstraZeneca as well, because these are really the company that now are going full speed, real investment, and have like really teams that are using AI day in, day out. So that will be interesting to see if we see any impact on their pipeline and their pipeline velocity in the next 5 years.
And I think the interesting thing is also that the bigger pharma companies, I mean, they're not as public about it. I mean, for the tech bios, it's their language, right? They need to put it out there every little step that they take. But for a bigger pharma, they might just do a lot of things with AI and don't like communicate as much about it, maybe like on a conference, but it's not like a press release about every single step of the way.
You're right. Not as much, but in conference they do, because I think there is now a lot of discussion also about, are the large pharma getting the right talent? Mm. So I was at a panel discussion at the Swiss Biotech Day a few weeks ago, and there was one of my panelists who is an MLOps lead at Roche, who was saying that they were making several hundreds of millions of predictions per week in his team. So it's really like proper production level AI. And now, yes, we need to have the right talent, because it's not, you know, I'm a biologist by background. You know, it's not me that they need. You know, they need someone who understands computer science, who, yeah, has a feel also for biology. So that's why I think the role of translator, people who can understand the both domain, is becoming more and more important. And pharma is still not necessarily really, really good at getting those people or making the pharma like the one place where people want to go.
Which brings us to the next topic, maybe. Do we still need human scientists, or?
I love it.
I was just having this exact same thought, that in the day of AI and AI co-scientists, what the heck are you talking about talent anymore, right?
So it's a great question. I think, I mean, if you ask me for today and in the next 5 years, I still think that we need
more talent.
That we need more talent. And I mean, you see like a lot of AI companies, you know, whether they are in life science or not, they still hire quite a bit. What happens is that they are changing their talent mix. So there is a lot of letting people go, but still, you know, like a lot of companies who are letting a lot of people go, they are also hiring a large number of people. So I think there is a bit of a renewal of the type of people they need. But now if you ask, do we still need people? I think you need to consider two aspects, at least today. There is on one hand, optimization, and then on the other hand, discovery. For optimization, I'll argue very often that we don't want human in the loop. if you take something like, okay, I want to find the optimal condition to grow a certain cell line. So what is it that you have 4 or 5 parameters, you know, the temperature, the pH, the concentration of a bunch of different salt, and you need to change those parameters and then see what happens and then, you know, do it in a loop. To be honest, I mean, most of the time people, if they intervene, they will mess it up. And, you know,
humans are just bothering.
Yeah, I mean, because we know that we have this problem of reproducibility in life science.
Right.
And, you know, I've seen in my own PhD, you know, like one of my key experiments during my PhD, I don't know if I should say that publicly, but, you know, it was almost impossible to reproduce. It was such a headache. And then we realized actually that we had some contamination in the buffer that we were using that came directly from the factory.
Yeah.
It took us months to realize that.
Yes. We once had algae growing in like a buffer which was like, it was sealed and you open it and then suddenly you saw like this little fluorescent algae in this.
And you realized that they were essential for your experiment?
Yes. Well, I was not studying cells anymore. I was studying algae at that point. But yeah, it's interesting. And I think one interesting conclusion of what you say is that a lot of the tech bios or also like this, for example, ARC Institute, are investing into producing their own data now, right? Because it's like taking just the biomedical data from public repositories and from the literature. It's too messy. So it's easier just to let robotic system do data production under really controlled conditions rather than trying to fit all this messy data together.
And it's not just that. I mean, a lot of public data is positive data, not negative data.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, I worked for a publishing company where I was on the data side and the development of digital tools. But a lot of data that are in publication are, you know, like the thing that actually worked. So I have an 11-year-old daughter. And when she's complaining about things not working, I say, look, you know, in my job, we fail 95% of the time. So that's kind of normal. But then this 95% is invisible because that's not what people want to read. However, that's what the algorithm wants to read. You know, the algorithm wants those 95%, not just the 5%, because you need to train them with what works and what doesn't work. I had a project actually with the FDA in one of my former company where they reached out to us and they said, look, we want to train models to predict hepatotoxicity. And the problem, as we have the FDA, is that no one sends us things that trigger hepatotoxicity because then we will tell them, we don't want your drug. I mean, it's quite bad. So they had all the positive signal, but they say, can you share with us the negative signal? And of course, pharma companies have plenty of things that, you know, trigger hepatotoxicity. But then you enter also into all the discussion on, well, do pharma companies want to share their negative data? And I think this is one of the things which is, you know, which is changing at the moment. There is a bit more willingness to share. You've seen that with Eli Lilly and their Tune Lab, where they are sharing a lot of data. I think there was a partnership between BMS and Takeda, where they were doing a lot of data sharing. So a lot more pre-competitive stuff. But just to go back to one of your questions, I was saying, so there is on one hand the optimization, where I think...
You don't need people anymore?
You don't necessarily need human. But then there is the discovery part, and the discovery is where I will say at the moment, I'm not saying what will happen in 6 months, and we'll discuss about AI co-scientists that are already doing interesting things in this area. But at the moment, I think it's still interesting or it's still important to have people asking those fuzzy questions, because sometimes it's even difficult to formulate the question. And if you can't formulate the question properly, then it's difficult to give the right context to any AI system. So there is still a bit of, you know, back and forth where you still need to experiment and leave space also for serendipity, you know, for the accidental discovery. So I don't know if the AI system are good at, you know, can they discover penicillin? You know, this type of thing. I don't know. It might happen.
How would you, because I mean, this term AI scientist, AI co-scientist, whatever it is flying around a lot.
Yep.
And I think there's different things that different people mean by it. And we talked about it last year when this Stanford Virtual Lab and Google co-scientist came out. It's almost exactly a year ago that we talked about it. But how would you define what is an AI scientist?
Okay, so I'll give you an example of a discussion I had recently. So there is this company called Edison Scientific. that released a product called Cosmos recently. And when they released it, they also released a paper where they did a partnership with wet lab scientists who took the AI co-scientist and tested it in the lab. So I had an interview soon to be released when I'm done with the editing or when my partner is done with the editing, where I asked him, you know, what is it that he did with that? And I think I'll describe it so that for me, it was a good example of what is an AI co-scientist. So the researcher is an Alzheimer researcher. So he had a data set, which was a gene expression data set. So he took this gene expression data set, fed it to Cosmos, the AI co-scientist, and then Cosmos started to do analysis, started to generate ideas. Like, say, oh, I see that there is a downregulation of the genes. So my first idea is that another cell type must be upregulated. So it went, checked the idea, and realized, no, actually, both are downregulated. So it went and fetched other ideas from the literature and other data set, and then started to generate ideas, test them, generate more ideas, test them. And the way the scientist was describing this to me is that it started to be, you know, like an octopus, but with 1,000 arms and testing so many things in parallel at the same time, to the point where it became almost scary, because although, you know, this type of system will describe, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, it does so much and so much in parallel that it becomes almost scary, because you can't follow. You know, it comes to a point where a human brain cannot follow. And I think this is really the power of AI co-scientists, this ability of testing and connecting things that a human brain cannot do. It's, you know, exponential. And then building new theory and testing them. And then I think you can take it to a point where, for me, the most interesting, and we'll talk about it later, is if you can connect that to the lab and generate some data to test them. Because at the moment, the bottleneck is that it will generate an idea, and then when it's running out of papers or data set, it will tell you, well, now this is the experiment that I'm proposing.
That's your turn.
And you need to generate, yeah, you're kind of serving the robot. To finish the narrative here is that he said, after, you know, like all the analysis, it came up with a new theory and said, okay, my theory is that this cell type or the cell population in Alzheimer is dying because there is an enzyme which is controlled that will control the membrane flipping mechanism that exposes a protein at the surface, which is recognized by a cell type that will kill this specific population of cells. It was a completely new biological mechanism, which was not known. Again, it's not something that will, you know, give him a Nobel Prize, but it's the type of paper, you know, that people publish that contribute to improving the knowledge little by little. Then they took that, they went to the lab, tested it, and after a couple of months realized that was absolutely true. Yeah. So for me, that's the definition of an AI co-scientist. That's really the type of thing that can take a data set, generate idea, test them in a certain way, and then, you know, do this in an iterative manner, and then eventually connect to the lab to even be able to test thing on its own, or partner with a human to say, that's the next thing that you need to do. And what the researcher was telling me is that it has completely changed his way of doing research, because now it's more managing a bunch of agents than in the past. For instance, he would have taken his gene expression data set, spent hours or days, you know, doing the analysis himself. So it's really like compressing the whole research workflow in hours rather than days or weeks.
So at the end of the day, it's iterations on steroids.
Yeah. And I think something also which is important, not just the iteration, but the connecting things that are so far apart that normally you will really have a hard time connecting yourself.
We had an older episode that we called Expanding the Option Space. I think that's exactly what it's doing. It's giving within the rule book more options. I have a slightly philosophical question on that. I mean, you started with this nice statistic on how many diseases there are, how many drugs there are, and what's the connection between the two of them. So what I'm wondering about, because I think there are two ways that this idea of using more pattern-driven drug discovery, using AI, using automation could go. I mean, on the one hand, you could imagine that you follow down avenues that humans didn't think of and you discover truly new things. On the other hand, we just had this example of positive publication bias, of having a narrowing of literature base, basically. And I think this is something that was an interesting study out in Nature the other day, where they said that scientists who use AI become more productive, but overall, the types of topics that are being studied is actually getting smaller. I mean, it was, I think, only by 5% or something, but still. So the question would be, and I think this is something that with agentic systems, also in other areas, people are finding, right, that it seems to break down things to this over time to like simplification to a smaller denominator. Would you say it's going in the broader direction, so broader option space, or would you say it's going in the narrower direction, or we just don't know?
I think we don't know, to be honest.
I see where it comes from, because it also, you know, like if you look at language, I think a lot of people are saying, you know, people using LLM to write, it tends to unify or harmonize how people talk. I think that's definitely one of the challenge. But is it a challenge because people are not using the tool in the right way? Or is it inherent to the tool itself? I mean, one of the things I've done recently, because of course, I mean, I use AI for so many things, for writing, but I went back to, you know, the pre-GPT time to find all of my writing, you know, that I had in my emails. I took my PhD dissertation and I loaded all that into Claude to say, can you extract my pattern and my style? So, you know, I think it's also a matter of how this is trained, and can you train it in another way so that it's deviating from the mean? Again, I think you will have to ask a computer scientist. That's my feeling, that maybe it's just also a phase, you know, in those tools. I mean, we are aware of that. We are aware of the limitation. And I think these are things that require a bit more research and a bit more development. Again, you know, like things are evolving so fast, and the thing that was a limitation a month ago is not a limitation anymore today. So I'm quite optimistic, because I think, you know, like people are aware of that, and there is so much investment going in those tools that, you know, like a lot of the things that we considered a barrier or limitation are being overcome quite quickly.
Aren't people going to say rather sooner than later, well, I'm fine with that, even if it's a limitation? I mean, people who use LLMs at a certain point say, okay, I make my peace here. And, yeah. And why bother?
This is right? Like in the first episode we had on ChatGPT, just after like it came out, we discussed with a mathematician about it and what the predictions. And I think there are certain text-heavy tasks that are slightly nonsensical, I have to say, or are maybe not the right way to make sense of the world that we have like given to ourselves, just read and write a lot, but it's kind of the stuff that nobody really likes to write and read. And maybe this is what the LLMs will take over, and it's also fine. And I mean, there are certain areas, like for example, writing essays at university. I mean, this is just something we need to think about, how to integrate AI in a smart way, because it's a little bit like saying, yeah, no, I don't want to use the internet. I mean, there is no way back. Now we have it. Now we have to learn how to deal with it. And I think this is, we're going to learn bottom how line. To deal with it. But at the same time, I think we need to make sure that it does not dumb down everything, but that we actually use it in a way to expand our intelligence rather than make us all sound like ChatGPT or Claude or friends.
But I think we are still in this learning phase where, you know, like it's not a straight line. I think, you know, like it goes up and down, and then, you know, like at some point people realize, okay, that works, that doesn't work, you know, that makes us more stupid. But I think, you know, like it's like every technological revolution, you need to experiment, see what works, what doesn't work. The difference between this technological revolution and the previous one is that it's going so fast that I think people just have a hard time coping with the space of development. But, you know, when you were talking, I was thinking about something that I've seen recently, you know, talking about the tasks that people don't like, you know, work email. And you know, when you have this colleague that sends very long work email that you don't want to read. So I have a colleague recently who sent with his long work email, he say, I'm sending you this long work email, but there is a markdown document that you can download so that you can, I'm making it easy for you to put it into your AI tool, because you know that people will not necessarily read it. So that's the thing which is interesting now, is that the AI chatbot, whatever, you know, the one you're using, is becoming the thing that we use to produce content, but also to read content. So it's an interpreter between human. Which I think, you know, like going back into the philosophy thing, is very interesting, because is this the type of interpreter you want? Is it going to change the way we interact with other people? I find this fascinating.
I mean, it kind of does already, right? Yeah. I mean, the way that especially emails are being written is changing drastically through ChatGPT or other LLMs. I mean, the point about the speed of this revolution is really interesting that you made, because I think we keep forgetting how short it is that we had these LLMs and agentic systems at our disposal and are expecting also like super great performance. And at the same time, it's like, I don't know, a year, 2 years, 3 years that they have been rolled out. And we're like, really taking baby steps. But I think this is also something that scares a lot of people. And I can imagine also in the science space, of course, did you get any feedback, insights from people? Are people scared of AI scientists, AI co-scientists? Are they afraid that they will become obsolete or that they're job will change drastically?
I didn't necessarily get that. I still get quite a lot of signal that people are dismissive. So if I go back to this scientist that I was telling you about, who is working for, you know, in a very large, prestigious university, and now, I mean, this tool has changed the way he's doing science. And he was telling me that he had to interact with people, you know, that are very senior in his university who still haven't even tried it. So I think you still have a lot of people who are dismissive. I worked for an organization where you also had like two very separate parts of the organization. Some people were really enthusiastic. And I think with enthusiasm, sometimes, you know, you have a bit of positive bias. But then on the other hand, you had people that were so negative that they didn't want to touch it because they were extremely dismissive. And again, I think, you know, the truth is somewhere in between. These are tools that, as you said, that are developing at an incredible pace. So the yesterday's limitation will be fixed with the next update. Now, is it working for everything? No, but this is definitely, you know, going back to what I was saying at the beginning, you know, about the challenges that we have with the number of diseases and the number of drugs. I always tell people who are dismissive with AI, look, it's not like the way we do drug discovery and development today is perfect. I mean, I don't want to wait 500 years to fix everything. As you said, our health system cannot absorb the cost. So maybe AI is not perfect, but so far, it's our best shot at addressing real problem that we have today. Just continuing to do things the way we've done for the past 30 years is not going to solve it. So if you have something else to offer, hey, I'd love to see it and be my guest. You know, it will. I'm open to any new way of doing things and solving known problem where we can all agree on what is the problem and what is the magnitude of the problem. Where we might disagree is how to solve it. But what I'm saying is that I'm seeing signals with AI that are quite positive. Still just signals, but I haven't seen those signals with other approaches.
One small, maybe one sentence extension to the philosophical question when it comes to R&D in general, and of course the AI co-scientist. You were mentioning that, in a nutshell, we don't understand anymore what's going on under the hood. We don't know yet, but we start using and trusting at the same time. Well, that's kind of scary.
So I think that we need to unpack the question.
Okay.
Okay, I have an anecdote. A couple of weeks ago, there was one of the first warning letter from the FDA to a company that submitted a regulatory document. I think it was a QC document where they said what they had done to do the QC of one of their product. And the thing was straight out of ChatGPT, complete hallucination. The FDA had to tell the company, look, you're responsible for what you're submitting. You can use any tool you want, but eventually you're the one signing it and you're the one responsible. So if you submit something, better be something that is real and not hallucination. So, I mean, eventually, I think, you know, we can't offload completely our responsibility to a robotic system or to an AI system. In the end, you know, we don't have AGI or SGI yet. You know, whatever is proposed, I think, you know, we are still going back to the human in the loop type of, you know, question is, where is it that we are in the loop? And where we are in the loop is, you know, there is a proposal or there is a conclusion. It's ours to validate. It's ours to test. But you're raising an important point about the transparency and how much we understand about the algorithm. There is a lot of companies that are trying to, you know, to provide transparency on what's going on under the hood. I was at a conference in Barcelona recently where there was a company that was taking the kind of black box algorithm and trying to derive the rules from the black box algorithm to be able to say, when there is this prediction, these are the things that were taken into consideration by the algorithm to come up with this prediction. So it was degrading a little bit the quality of the algorithm itself, but it made it much more transparent. Right. So that's one approach of going forward. And again, if you compare it to the early days of ChatGPT, when you asked the question and then it gave you an answer, now we still have also, you know, the thing, you know, you can follow how the system is thinking. It's not perfect, but I think everyone agrees it's a challenge. We still want to have a feeling that we are in control. So we still want to be able to, you know, open the hood and see how it works underneath. Now, I mean, if you think about 10 years or 20 years from now, maybe you're good with mechanics. I have no idea how my car functions, and I'm absolutely fine with that. So maybe in 20 years, we'll be like, you know, we trust those things enough that we don't necessarily need to understand exactly what's happening. We are still in the early days, so we are still like, I like you, but I don't trust you yet. So tell me what you're doing. Mm-hmm. I think that's where we are.
And I think there is one other part of that, and you kind of mentioned that. I think, I mean, not all AI is deep learning. Rule-based AI will not hallucinate in the same way. So I think we will also go back to, or we are already at a stage where we also will have hybrid applications. So I think, for example, for QC, you might not necessarily use a deep learning model, or, I mean, really depends on the use case. And for some, you just want absolute certainty, and then you might use a different AI model. And for some, you have more room for error. But also, as you say, and I mean, we have this example a lot of the self-driving car, right? You're very forgiven to a human driver who makes many mistakes and who might be too old, too tired, too drunk, too blind, too whatever to drive. And we're like, yeah, but that's a human. They know what they're doing. And then you have a self-driving car who makes really, I mean, proven a lot less mistakes than a human driver would do. But because it's a robotic system, and I mean, because of the legal issues involved, we don't trust this system in the same way. And I think, I mean, as we learn to accept that AI systems, and I think probably it will not forever be large language models, and I think there will be probably different tools emergent that have more world knowledge, that have more understanding. And I mean, that's a clear situation, right, that we want the system to have more reasoning capacity, to have more understanding of how things really work instead of just hallucinating them together in an almost perfect way. But I think we will learn to know when to trust these systems and when not to trust them. And I really like, and we had that in a past episode, this quote from Ben Evans, that having agentic AI or having AI is having like infinite interns for your work. Yeah. And this is, I think, the perfect analogy. You have like a system that does something that's pretty good, and maybe it's not perfect, but it still takes away, I mean, it still helps you. And you just need to decide when you can trust it and when not.
Yeah, I agree with what you say. I think we are way more forgiving with our colleagues than what we are with AI systems. The number of times I had this discussion when people were telling me, oh, you know, I don't like it, it's not perfect. And, you know, the thing that I was telling them is, well, are your colleagues absolutely perfect? I mean, you know, we have much higher expectation for an AI system than what we have for humans. So I fully agree with you.
How would you say, I mean, where do you see the for the future trends, also when it comes to automation, AI scientists, AI and discovery, where do you see the biggest impact and the biggest challenges?
There are a number, you know, if you look at the whole pharma workflow. Interestingly, we still don't have a lot of new targets. You know, we talked about those 24,000 diseases. If I don't know if I have my number right or not, but I think there are approximately, you know, 20,000 targets. And I think we keep making drugs for like 700. So I'm like, okay, what about the other one? So still waiting for new innovative targets. Out of all those targets, people will say, oh, there are things that are so-called undruggable target. But I think this is also where, okay, can we have those system helping us with things that are, you know, that don't have like those deep pockets that are easy to drug. So, you know, can we develop more molecular glue or come up with new mechanism and new mode of action that we never thought about? I think that's where I'm quite hopeful for AI to find new target that we haven't explored and new ways of interacting with those targets. Of course, better understanding the mechanism of disease as well. There is also one thing that's kind of my pet peeve. You know, when I look at how we develop drugs, it's still very much one disease, one drug, which I think is extremely naive, because if you look at a map of metabolism, I mean, it's so complex. You know, you have things going in every direction. So if you block something, it's like in a city, you know, like if you have a road and you block this road, it doesn't necessarily block the whole city. You will have escape roads. And I think it's the same for diseases. So I talked to a lot of scientists who say, look, that might be a direction where AI can really help, is thinking about those treatment that will be way more complex, where you have not only multiple drugs, but you also think about how do you time it so that you really understand the disease progression and how to block the different avenues of disease. So that's one thing. But the other big thing is the acceleration of clinical trials. So the FDA now is experimenting with not the sequential way of doing clinical trial, which is, you know, you do years of discovery, then you start the clinical trial in different phase, and then that takes also years. But now they are doing the continuous monitoring. In many ways, you know, what happened during COVID, where we were able to really squeeze thing, you know, to the maximum because we had no choice, you know, bringing back this way of thinking and to some extent also taking calculated risk, you know, if we can do that with a combination of changing how we evolve the regulation and how we bring AI, I think these are things also that it's are very interesting avenues.
Yeah. Your approach, which is fascinating, promising from the scientific point of view, most definitely, gets into the way of traditional models of making business.
Yeah, but when you think about it, I mean, the blockbuster is necessary when you have something that takes 12 years and costs $6
billion. I know.
If you have something that takes, you know, like I'm kind of exaggerating just for the sake of argument. Instead of 10 years, if it takes 1 year and costs $100 million, then you can think about completely different business model. And I think that's the thing also, which is very interesting, and I'm not so much into the commercial part of pharma and the business model of pharma, but as the science is evolving, I think that will have an impact on the model. And we talked at the beginning of our discussion of, you know, prevention versus treatment. You evolve a model with more prevention, you have treatment that are more personalized, that are more complex, that are cheaper. It's a complete revolution of the whole healthcare system. So, you know, like that's so big, and, you know, like I certainly have an opinion. I'm not necessarily an expert. I don't know if there are a lot of experts who can talk about R&D, clinical, commercial, healthcare. I mean, that's a big, big space.
Yeah, I mean, the headline of this podcast is the Biorevolution podcast, and this is where we're at.
Yeah.
I'll ask again. Where would you say are the challenges? Is it like the data, the model, the people, the infrastructure, all of the above?
I think all of the above. I spent many years in the data space, making the argument that, you know, we can't do any of the things that we are doing now if we don't have good data. So I still think that our data are terrible. Why? Because we are not, the pharma industry is a data heavy industry, but life scientists are not data people. So the way life scientists was thinking, you know, a few years ago and still thinking to a large extent, is that I have a problem. I'm designing an experiment, producing data, analyzing the data, and then, you know, like deriving some conclusion, and I move on. It's very linear. What happens with the data? You keep them somewhere because either you have to from a regulatory standpoint, or because, you know, that's what you do. I mean, you keep them in one of your folder, but it's very linear. Now we've been forced to rethink things in a much more circular, in a loop, in a learning loop type of way. But then, you know, like when we say organizations sit on goldmine of data, I mean, for me, this is absolute BS. Because if you look at the old data, I mean, I've looked into archives of large companies. What does it mean to look into legacy data, old data? You go into someone's laptop, you open the file, you look at some Excel files, and then the Excel file doesn't really have any information. You sometimes don't even have colon header. Mm-hmm. What do you do with this Excel file? Nothing, because it's just a bunch of numbers. So you can't really derive any knowledge from that. So I think that's where we need to evolve. And one of the very strong case I'm always making, you know, with people I'm talking to, also with client, is that it's great to think about the old thing that you have, but fix the forward flow of information. Why? Because we have tools that are helping us generate more data. And I think it's predicted that in the next 5 years, we'll generate more data than in the history of humanity. So, you know, it's really like, it's an exponential thing. And people are always humans are not good at understanding exponential. I always tell them, fix your new data. Of course, you know, there is a value in the old data, but I think we spend so much money trying to rescue old data that we forgot that we need to fix the new data first. Good. Because that will be your new data, will be your old data, you know, in a month. So fix that. So that, I think that answers part of your question. The data foundation, I still think that we are far from ideal. And I mean, because of my professional background, most of my network is in data. The interesting thing is that people still have a hard time making an argument that they need to get funding to create good data. Why? Because data are not sexy. You know, like people want to spend money and have an AI application. You know, like everyone gives money to for AI applications. So now it's interesting. So there is this concept of fair data, you know, findable, accessible, interoperable, blah, blah, blah. So I was talking to a very senior IT person recently, and he was telling me, we don't call them fair data anymore. We call them AI-ready data. Yeah. It's the same thing, but we get more money for that. Yeah. So data foundation is one thing. Then the other thing is people. People is the main thing. Why? Because the technical problem eventually will solve them. Mm-hmm. But then the people, how people work together, the mentality, the changing your way of doing things, that's the much more difficult thing. And it's interesting because as I'm getting older, I think the thing that fascinates me the most is the people problem, is how you get people to work together. I worked in an organization years ago where we had an AI team full of engineers, and then we had the medicinal chemists. They hated each other. Right. You know, like the AI people will send us a list of molecules that came out of the algorithm. They will send it to the medicinal chemist, and medicinal chemists will look at it and say, my intuition tells me it's wrong, and they don't know what they are talking about anyway. Then the engineer will say, oh, you know, those old school medicinal chemists, you know, they don't live with their time. And it was really about getting people in a room, making sure that they realize that they are not the enemy, that they are working on solving the same problem. And that's going on in every organization. So solving this problem is one of the number one thing, you know, if you want to get people working together against a common goal.
I think it's also a question of the subject matter experts who think they have their juridic knowledge that only they have and that no one else can recreate. And then usually you're not very open to new things, because I think it's also kind of your business model as a person in this company to be the only person who knows right. stuff.
But to your point also, there is of course a fear, or, you know, am I going to be replaced? And that's something that we should not discard. Of course, there is this fear, but then how do we bring people along in the journey? And I think the biggest quality that we will need moving forward is people who can operate, you know, in different universe, in different space, you know, who have a strong subject matter expertise, but have a good feeling and a good understanding of the other domain, and, you know, and likewise in the other direction. And this is the type of people that are open enough to try new things, to try to understand, to appreciate things that are not perfect, and to be able to cope with imperfection. That's what we need now, because we are in this transition phase between, you know, the old way of doing things and the new way of doing things. That's messy. And we need people who can deal with messiness.
Wonderful. And I think one thing that I'm really hearing and that I'm also feeling from many, many things we discussed about AI, I mean, we need to find a way to work and to deal with it, because there is no way back. It will not go away again. And we need 100%. To, one way or the other, need to adapt ourselves, our work systems, our processes to include it, because otherwise...
I mean, one of the things that really triggers me is when I start to see, you know, organization or company or whatever saying we are banning AI or blocking AI. And I think this is so stupid.
Ridiculous.
I mean, you know, we are, you know, whether you like it or not, AI is here. It's not going to go away. So I think it's more about understanding, experimenting, not being an unrealistic enthusiast, but being, you know, being actually realist and say, look, it's here. It's imperfect, but we need to live with our time. I mean, it's like saying, oh, we are not using internet, or we are not using this or that tool. When I see, for instance, in school that they want to ban the use of LLMs, and I'm like, the problem is not banning LLM. The problem is a stupid use of the tool. And I keep telling people, look, you know, kids will use it anyway. So when you interrogate them, you know, don't just read what they bring you, but tell them to explain. I don't really care if they wrote it or not. Did they actually understand what they wrote? Can they explain it without looking at it?
And yeah. I think, I mean, there is also, I think one of the, again, going back to the, I think often the teachers are further behind than the kids when it comes to the use of AI. So, I mean, they're also scared, I think, to have like this tool that they don't understand, but...
And you can't blame them. I think, you know, like they are, it's not like no one was really trained. We are in this huge societal transformation where no one was ready for that. No one was educated for that. No one was trained for that. So some of the best organizations now are putting the right programs in place. But, you know, going back to the school system, I remember when ChatGPT was launched and there were a bunch of countries, you know, banning it. You know, I think Italy banned it, mm-hmm. Australia as well. The one country who said, we will have ChatGPT in our curriculum, it was Singapore, which is interesting because Singapore is, you know, regarded as the, you know, one of the best place when it comes to education. And I was like, well, that makes sense. I mean, they understood that this is here and we need to treat this as one of this change that now is part of the life of the kids. So let's make sure that they understand the tool and that we can operate with this tool in an intelligent way.
I think this is pretty good for closing remarks. Yes, as far as I'm concerned, we could go on for another like 2, 3, 4 hours, but we're going to re-invite you most definitely, I think.
Let's see about our predictions in a couple
absolutely.
Of
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Always and, nice to go back.
I mean, we're taking out everybody, including teachers, for that matter, have to leave their natural habitats.
Yeah.
And we have to become friends with messy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All of us, be it scientists, be it people in public service, be it citizens, right? That's a very fascinating take out. New business models, new scientific approaches when it comes to drug development. This is a fantastic, overwhelming journey, I would say, what we've been discussing and more ahead. This was the BioRevolution podcast. Thibaut, thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Izzy.
Many thanks to the both of you.
Please make sure to like us at Spotify or Apple or any other podcast platform of your liking. You may want to check out our liner notes and want to visit our homepage at
science-tales.com.
Thank you. See you around next time. Bye-bye.